The blizzard increased to terrific gusts during the night, causing us much anxiety for the safety of our hut. There was little sleep, all being apprehensive of the canvas roof ripping off and the boats being blown out to sea. Thus it continued, alternating between southwest blizzards when they were all confined to the hut and northeast winds bringing cold, damp, misty weather. On June 25th, a severe storm from the northwest was recorded, accompanied by strong winds and heavy seas, which encroached upon their little sandy beach up to within 4 yards of their hut. Towards the end of July and the beginning of August, they had a few fine, calm, clear days. Occasional glimpses of the sun with high temperatures were experienced after southwest winds had blown all the ice away, and the party, their spirits cheered by Wilde's unfailing optimism, again began to look eagerly for the rescue ship. The first 3 attempts at their rescue unfortunately coincided with the times when the island was beset with ice, and though on the second occasion we approached close enough to fire a gun in the hope that they would hear the sound and know that we were safe and well, yet so accustomed were they to the noise made by the calving of the adjacent glacier that either they did not hear or the sound passed unnoticed. On August 16th, pack was observed on the horizon, and next day the bay was filled with loose ice, which soon consolidated. Soon afterwards, huge old floes and many bergs drifted in. The pack appears as dense as we have ever seen it. No open water is visible, and ice blink girdles the horizon. The weather is wretched, a stagnant calm of air and ocean alike, the latter obscured by dense pack through which no swell can penetrate, and a wet mist hangs like a pall over land and sea. The silence is oppressive. There is nothing to do but stay in one's sleeping bag, or else wander in the soft snow and become thoroughly wet. 15 inches of snow fell in the next 24 hours, making over 2 feet between August 18th and 21st. A slight swell next day from the northeast ground up the pack ice, but this soon subsided, and the pack became consolidated once more. On August 27th, a strong west-southwest wind sprang up and drove all this ice out of the bay, and except for some stranded bergs, left a clear ice-free sea through which we finally made our way from Punta Arenas to Elephant Island. As soon as I had left the island to get help for the rest of the expedition, Wilde set all hands to collect as many seals and penguins as possible, in case their stay was longer than was at first anticipated. A sudden rise in temperature caused the whole lot to go bad and become unfit for food, so while a fair reserve was kept in hand, too much was not accumulated. At first, the meals, consisting mostly of seal meat with one hot drink per day, were cooked on a stove in the open. The snow and wind, besides making it very unpleasant for the cook, filled all the cooking pots with sand and grit, so during the winter the cooking was done inside the hut. A little Cerebus salt had been saved, and this was issued out at the rate of 3/4 of an ounce per man per week. Some of the packets containing the salt had broken, so that all did not get the full ration. On the other hand, one man dropped his week's ration on the floor of the hut amongst the stones and dirt. It was quickly collected, and he found to his delight that he had enough now to last him for 3 weeks. Of course, it was not all salt. The hot drink consisted at first of milk made from milk powder up to about 1/4 of its proper strength. This was later on diluted still more, and sometimes replaced by a drink made from a pea soup-like packing from the Bovril sledging rations. For Midwinter's Day celebrations, a mixture of 1 teaspoonful of methylated spirit in a pint of hot water, flavoured with a little ginger and sugar, served to remind some of cocktails and Veuve Clicquot. At breakfast, each had a piece of seal or half a penguin breast. Luncheon consisted of 1 biscuit on 3 days a week, nut food on Thursday, bits of blubber from which most of the oil had been extracted for the lamps on 2 days a week, and nothing on the remaining day. On this day, breakfast consisted of a half-strength sledging ration. Supper was almost invariably seal and penguin, cut up very finely and fried with a little seal blubber. There were occasionally very welcome variations from this menu. Some paddies, a little white bird not unlike a pigeon, were snared with a loop of string and fried with 1 water-sodden biscuit for lunch. Enough barley and peas for 1 meal all round of each had been saved, and when this was issued it was a day of great celebration. Sometimes, by general consent, the luncheon biscuit would be saved, and, with the next serving of biscuit, was crushed in a canvas bag into a powder and boiled with a little sugar, making a very satisfying pudding. When blubber was fairly plentiful, there was always a saucepan of cold water made from melting down the pieces of ice which had broken off from the glacier, fallen into the sea, and been washed ashore, for them to quench their thirst in. As the experience of Arctic explorers tended to show that seawater produced a form of dysentery, Wilde was rather diffident about using it. Penguin carcasses boiled in one part of seawater to four of fresh were a great success, though, and no ill effects were felt by anybody. The ringed penguins migrated north the day after we landed at Cape Wilde, and though every effort was made to secure as large a stock of meat and blubber as possible, by the end of the month the supply was so low that only one hot meal a day could be served. Twice the usual number of penguin steaks were cooked at breakfast, and the ones intended for supper were kept hot in the pots by wrapping up in coats, etc. Clark put our saucepan full in his sleeping bag today to keep it hot, and it really was a great success, in spite of the extra helping of reindeer hairs that it contained. In this way we can make 10 penguin skins do for one day. Some who were fortunate enough to catch penguins with fairly large undigested fish in their gullets used to warm these up in tins hung on bits of wire round the stove. All the meat intended for hooshes is cut up inside the hut, as it is too cold outside. As the boards which we use for the purpose are also used for cutting up tobacco, when we still have it, a definite flavour is sometimes imparted to the hoosh, which, if anything, improves it. Their diet was now practically all meat, and not too much of that, and all the diaries bear witness to their craving for carbohydrates, such as flour, oatmeal, etc. One man longingly speaks of the cabbages which grow on Kerguelen Island. By June 18th there were only 900 lumps of sugar left, i.e., just over 40 pieces each. Even my readers know what shortage of sugar means at this very date, but from a different cause. Under these circumstances, it is not surprising that all their thoughts and conversation should turn to food, past and future banquets, and second helpings that had been once refused. A census was taken, each man being asked to state just what he would like to eat at that moment, if he were allowed to have anything that he wanted. All, with but one exception, desired a suet pudding of some sort, the duff beloved of sailors. Macklin asked for many returns of scrambled eggs on hot buttered toast. Several voted for a prodigious Devonshire dumpling, while Wilde wished for any old dumpling so long as it was a large one. The craving for carbohydrates, such as flour and sugar and for fats, was very real. Marston had with him a small penny cookery book. From this he would read out one recipe each night so as to make them last. This would be discussed very seriously, and alterations and improvements suggested, and then they would turn into their bags to dream of wonderful meals that they could never reach. The following conversation was recorded in one diary. Wilde: Do you like doughnuts? McElroy: Rather. Wilde: Very easily made, too. I like them cold with a little jam. McElroy: Not bad. But how about a huge omelette? Wilde: Fine. With a deep sigh. Overhead, two of the sailors are discussing some extraordinary mixture of hash, applesauce, beer, and cheese. Marston is in his hammock, reading from his penny cookery book. Farther down, someone eulogizes Scotch shortbread. Several of the sailors are talking of spotted dog, sea pie, and Lockhart's with great feeling. Someone mentions nut food, whereat the conversation becomes general, and we all decide to buy 1 pound's worth of it as soon as we get to civilization and retire to a country house to eat it undisturbed. At present we really mean it, too. Midwinter's Day, the great polar festival, was duly observed. A magnificent breakfast of sledging ration hoosh, full strength and well boiled to thicken it, with hot milk was served. Luncheon consisted of a wonderful pudding invented by Wilde, made of powdered biscuit boiled with 12 pieces of mouldy nut food. Supper was a very finely cut seal hoosh flavoured with sugar. After supper they had a concert, accompanied by Hussey on his indispensable banjo. This banjo was the last thing to be saved off the ship before she sank, and I took it with us as a mental tonic. It was carried all the way through with us, and landed on Elephant Island practically unharmed, and did much to keep the men cheerful. Nearly every Saturday night such a concert was held, when each one sang a song about some other member of the party. If that other one objected to some of the remarks, a worse one was written for the next week. The cook, who had carried on so well and for so long, was given a rest on August 9th, and each man took it in turns to be cook for 1 week.